You're listening to the Infinite Loopback Podcast, an Apple-themed technology podcast hosted by Brian Baggett, Jim Graham, and Brad Tarver. All right, we're back again. We're still breaking format this second time. You know, last time we talked about our first experiences on the internet and what that was like. And now we're going to discuss our very first computers and what that was like. So, Brad, why don't you kick us off? Tell us about your first computer. What'd you use it for? How did you get into it?
Our first computer, man, I had to be probably 10, 11, 12 years old. I was a kid, obviously. And it was a monochrome screen, just orange and black. And it had just a single 5 1/4 floppy drive in it. I know my parents probably spent $3,000 or $4,000 on this thing. It was ridiculous. And the case was as big as your dining room table. We probably had it a couple of weeks and I took it apart. I was the worst kid about taking stuff apart. I wanted to take everything apart and figure it out and look at it. I'm probably 3 or 4 years old and I find my dad's screwdriver and take his clock radio apart. You know, those kind of things. And growing up in the South, when you're a kid, everything you do, if you do that was a bad thing, you get a whipping. Basically, I took our new computer apart and I got a whipping. And then I put it back together. My parents were, of course, like, what are we going to do now? And I said, well, I'll just put it back together. So I put it back together and everything was all right. My feelings were hurt. And I think we used it to play some basic games. I mean, they weren't even as good as the games on the Atari 2600 or even the NES. And I don't know if that's just because we didn't think to buy the better games that would have been available then. I mean, of course, this is before CD-ROM. So, I mean, anything that you bought would have been on multiple floppy disks. But at some point, we got a second 5 1/4 to put into it so that I could actually load one thing and have another thing loaded at the same time to play a game or whatever it was that we were doing. But I remember using it to write papers. I think it had maybe Word 1.0 or some ancient version of WordPerfect that we used to write papers and then print them out on our, what were the old dot matrix printers, the real low resolution ones. It was like 12 or 14 dots per letter.
You could actually see the dots on the paper. It was so...
Exactly. It didn't even look like a line. It just looked like a grouping of dots. If you looked at it closely enough, it was almost like Braille. I didn't really have any other friends around that really had computers, and I don't really even know why my parents decided to buy it other than that we were going to use it to write papers. I mean, we still had to go and photocopy books at the library to be able to come home and write a paper about it. Or, you know, we had the huge set of World Book encyclopedias. So I remember being...
That was the internet when I was a kid.
Yeah, man. No, really, it was. And, you know, anything you needed to know, you would go to the M-N World Book and look it up. And then I'd wind up reading the rest of the book because what was the next article or whatever after whatever you were reading was just as interesting. And
you'd go down the wiki hole long before there's a Wikipedia.
Yeah, it was the World Book wiki hole.
I've never realized how similar our childhoods were, and I'll get into it in a minute, but I've never noticed how similar that the entire experience was. My World Books, though, were from 1960, and I grew up in the mid-80s, so there was we hadn't even gone to the moon yet. That was still a maybe one day we'll do this type of thing. And it's like, oh, this is too bad.
I remember being a kid, probably 7 or 8. And, you know, back then they sold books like that either door to door or you could get a subscription to it from like the Sears and Roebuck. And I remember the first, you know, the big box showing up that had all the A to Z through it. And mom signed up for an extra thing where you would get like a quarterly or a yearly science book that had all of the science discoveries and whatnot from the previous year. And so we wind up with a huge shelf full of these. And our World Books were blue with the embossed gold writing on them. So they were definitely an 80s edition, not the, you know, the red, brown, beige edition. That's probably from the 70s. Yours probably weren't even that color if you're talking about 60s.
Mine were white with green spines and yellow print on the spines.
I do remember that, seeing those at the libraries and whatnot. So I wrote plenty of papers out of those. Anyway, to get back on topic, like I said, I didn't really have any friends that, you know, were encouraging or were like, oh, your computer does this, mine does this. So it was, so I had friends that we wanted to play outside and ride our bikes and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I wasn't, of course, I wasn't spending a lot of time inside on the computer then, but it was definitely more prevalent in my home than it was in other people's homes at that time.
Interesting. Do you remember the model of computer that you had, or was it just a generic PC clone?
It was a generic PC clone. I mean, it wasn't even a, you know, you could think back and say, oh, was it a Tandy or what? It was just some off the shelf junk that we got at, I think, Sears and Roebuck. That was kind of our place to go when we lived in, when I was that age, we lived in South Jackson. So we always went to Metro Center for that stuff.
I know your age by the fact that you throw "and Roebuck" on that as well, because that was the way it was in my town as well. But we'll, I'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah. Sorry, I mean, everybody had a Sears and Roebuck.
Or South Jackson. Jackson, and he's going to the Metro Center. Well, yeah. You go there now and you might get shot.
For many years, that's been true.
I mean, that was the only mall we had when I was that age. You know, the North Park Mall didn't exist then. And obviously, this is all regional stuff that I'm talking about. You know, my little bitty town of Jackson, Mississippi.
That sits atop a dormant volcano.
That's right.
I actually remember going to that mall as a kid. I grew up with my grandparents, and they had relatives in Vicksburg. And we would drive over from Vicksburg to Metro, you know, as a kid, and walk around that mall. And I just remember thinking it was so big, multi-level, even that long ago. We're talking about 70s.
Well, now that building has now become some city offices for Jackson, and there's a local MDOT, I'm sorry, MDOT, the Highway Patrol office is there for, you could do your driving test around that part of Jackson. I took my daughter in there a couple of years ago to get her to take her driving test. And it was, you go in there and it's just amazing how small it looks, you know, from when you were a kid and you're like, man, this is the biggest building ever. And you go back and you think, well, you know, you could probably fit four of my houses in here. That would be it. it's so tiny compared.
That's interesting. We had sort of very, very similar circumstances there. So I'll go next. So I too was kind of a tinker a little bit as a kid, not really encouraged to do so for the same reasons, right? Things cost money. You don't want to take those things apart, but I've always had sort of an innate curiosity about a lot of things. Just to go off on a sidetrack for a moment, as we're talking about this again, you know, previous episode, we talked about, you know, there are people of a certain age that can't imagine this. And to really drive that point home, I have a guy that I worked with that I was sort of mentoring in Linux knowledge and those types of things. And very smart guy, very, very sharp guy, very proud of him and what he's done. But I would wonder sometimes, like, how is it that I know this stuff and he doesn't know this stuff? And the more that I thought about it, it's because this guy is considerably younger, like 15 years younger. For him, growing up, everything that was a computer was basically an appliance, like a toaster or a microwave or something, right? It already exists. It already does everything that I need it to do. I press a button and I get something out of it. And one of the recurring themes I think you're going to see here is when we were younger, that was not always the case. It was just sort of a blank slate in what you did with it. And you had to learn to do neat things to make it actually do anything useful. You kind of had to be a tinkerer to get some things out of it. So my first computer was a TI-99-4A. It was a general purpose computer built by Texas Instruments. It was not a PC clone. Probably famous now for the fact that Bill Cosby was its spokesperson in the 80s, and that wouldn't sell any computers today. But back then, that was considered sort of a big deal. They were kind of entry level computers. They did basic, and they would hook to your television. You didn't have to have a monitor. It was back when they were doing the whole thing where they would connect sort of like an Atari game system or a Nintendo Entertainment System
or Commodore.
Yes, or a Commodore. Really wanted a Commodore 64 or a VIC 20 or one of those, but my parents would not go for it. The Commodore it was probably priced a little bit higher, but the TI-99-4A, I think, had like a rebate or something on it that made it more of an attractive purchase. So I got this thing, and I'm trying to do things with it, trying to figure things out. In my family, I am the youngest grandchild by a lot, right? All of my cousins were all older than me. And I had one cousin who's probably 20 years older than me. She was married to a guy who just happened to have sort of a similar interest in those types of things. And I can remember being 8 or 9 and asking him questions. How do you do this in BASIC? How do you do that in BASIC? And asking, like, it never seemed weird to me as a kid talking to an adult like that, But if like one of my nephews or nieces started asking me computer questions at the same way that I was asking my cousin, I'd be like, wow, what's wrong with this kid? But it was very,
go outside and play.
Yeah. What do you even care about this for? But to his credit, he was very, very, very kind. Got me several books on programming, and he bought me this cassette recorder that I had that you could hook to your TI-99/4A. Now, in those days, you could actually use audio cassettes to load programs onto your computer, and the tape recorder had a counter on it. So the program might be, you would have to write down where the programs were. So 0.000 to 0.017 is this program. You would play it, and it would sound like a modem screeching while it did the interface. You would just hear, and then the program would load.
I'm going to go there too, by the way. So.
Oh, okay, cool. So I had several programs on cassette. I had several. They had cartridges for it too. It had cartridges and audio cassettes that you could use to load things into. So I can remember writing like little simple programs. They had one called Mr. Bojangles, and he would sit there and dance, and it was just an animated man. You would learn about moving sprites around here and there. And I used that for many years, probably from 84 to probably 89. That was my main computer. Over time, as it got more primitive and as I got older, you know, I lost interest in it a little bit. But by about 1990, I got a new computer. I convinced my parents to get an Amiga 500. Commodore Amiga 500. I never gave up the Commodore dream. I wanted a Commodore so badly. At the time, the Amiga in 1990 was a great machine if you like to play games. It had a custom graphics chip. It was very powerful. It was more powerful out of the box than comparable PCs at the time. If you're really old, you can remember XGA, EGA, CGA, VGA, all of those different requirements. And you'd want out, you'd get these games. And the really cool games were the VGA games with 256 colors. The Amiga boasted, I think, like 16,000 colors or something. Or 64,000 colors. It was a lot. It was a 16-bit processor, which was a big deal in the days of the...
Yeah, it would be 65,536 colors.
There we go. My memory was a little hazy, but you got it. So, you know, 65,000 colors. It ran a very, very basic version of DOS that was proprietary to the, I think they called it Workbench or something, if I'm remembering correctly. It's been so many years since I've touched this thing. And again, it was one of those things that would connect to your television. It had a basic word processor. It used that for a long time before I finally, you know, in the previous episode, we talked about the 486 SX25 that I had.
And now you're wishing you still had it so you could go dig it out and play.
You know, I kind of do. You'll see every once in a while, you'll see like an Amiga 500 emulator. You'll actually see some of these TI emulators, and it does kind of take you back to see those things. But from 84 to 94, I guess I only had really 10 years and two computers, well, three if you count that one at the very end of that 10-year period. But my formative years were largely, you know, it was a way to satiate that curiosity. You know, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have, in a small rural town, I mean, you guys grew up in much bigger towns compared to where I grew up in Mississippi. It was a very tiny town. I knew that there was a thing called BBSs that existed. There was none where I was. There was no way you could dial into it. Long distance was still a thing in those days. So you couldn't really dial anywhere. And that's why I talk to nerds of my age, and they're, you weren't on BBSs. It's like there was nothing to be had. I might as well have been growing up in Afghanistan for as far as technology goes.
You would have had to call Memphis from Water Valley, and even then it would have been, you know, a dollar a minute or something, and your parents would have given you a whipping.
I would have gotten the big whooping. You know, and it would either been Memphis or Jackson would have been the closest big cities, and both were about equidistant from where I was. So actually, Jackson's a little bit further, but still, it was not an easy thing for me to have gotten access to. I think what's something I meant to mention in the previous episode that we did was, it's really strange to me looking back now that so much of our lives now are dominated by the internet, and most of that, for even Jim being 4 years older, it's still the same thing where you could look at our lives and they're pretty much bisected in half. We have the internet era and the pre-internet era. So, you know, I'm of an age where I can remember, you know, I have to go outside and play, or if I'm going to be late, I have to find a payphone and call my parents. You know, it was such a different time. It was such a transformative effect that everything that came after, you can clearly divide your life in terms of from the moment that I had a cell phone that I could use all the time. There was never a piece of information that I couldn't look up. I'm always accessible. No matter where I am, someone can find me. Whereas in those days, you could get lost really easily. If you broke down, that was like, oh man, please, please let, you know, please let my vehicle be reliable. I have to tell people where I'm going, because if I don't.
If you get lost, you are broke down, you were walking to the next exit.
Pretty much.
You know, you couldn't just call somebody.
You could not just call somebody. Not easily. So it's strange. And so many people that are alive today that are younger have no idea. And it wasn't like this was like a billion years ago. This was 20 years ago. This was not that long a time in the grand scheme of things. Okay, maybe 22, 23 at this point, years ago, but still a long time. But, you know, the thing that was really nice for me was having that relative who fostered that curiosity and sort of encouraged it and really sort of put me on the path. And it still took a long time before I decided that was what I wanted to do for a living. But yeah, it definitely gave me an outlet for that curiosity. Jim, what about you? What about your first computing experience?
I also had an older plug-in to the TV computer. It was a Tandy Color Computer 2. I'm not sure around what year I got that. I was probably about 13 or so. So that would have been 1985. That was my first experience in computing. What was that computer? And it also had the tape drive, like you were describing, where you could save your stuff off to tape and buy things on tape to run on it. It was basic programming language on there. And I remember, you know, changing the screen colors and dancing the sprites around. And I remember writing math programs on there just to see how long it would, you know, like I specifically remember just writing a simple loop and letting it run just to see how long it would take my computer to count to a million. And, you know, it was like 4 hours or something, you know what I mean? Right.
Do you remember sub and go sub?
Yeah, exactly. You know, all that stuff. So that's kind of my first experience.
Like this computer's flash.
So it wouldn't do much. And then I'm going to skip ahead and not talk much about that one, because the one I really want to talk about is my first true PC, which I bought spring semester of my first year in graduate school. It was a Gateway 2000 computer, if everybody remembers when Gateway was still called Gateway 2000.
And the boxes were black and white, Cal print.
With Cal dots on it, yeah, with Cal print on the boxes. And so that computer, like I said, it was a Pentium 60 processor. So I actually waited. I remember waiting and ordering because the Pentiums were coming out and they were running commercials on it. And it was, you know, that was the thing. Get the Pentium instead of the 486.
Had the math coprocessor.
It had, I don't remember how much RAM it had. It was probably one megabyte. And we're talking megabytes, not gigabytes, but megabytes or 4 megabytes. The original hard drive, I do remember this, was like 240 megabytes. And I remember that specifically because a year or two into grad school, I'm running out of space because of Usenet. And I remember driving to Memphis from Oxford with my then wife, going to Egghead Computer Store in Memphis, which was like just amazing. I mean, just walking through Egghead then and seeing all the stuff that they had. And so I bought a 730 megabyte hard drive, and it was like $300, which was a lot of money for me in grad school, which took me to almost 1 gigabyte of hard drive space. And if you talk to Shelley at this point, she will still tell you this quote from me, that if I ever need more than this, then I'm a glutton for space. And I said this, you know, that it was...
You had your own Bill Gates moment.
I had to justify that $300, right? I mean, that's why I said it. It's because that was a lot of money to us. And so, you know, and it was a second hard drive. So I was adding the 240 plus the 730, almost 1 gigabyte. And I said that. I said, if I ever need more than this, then, you know, just I'm a glutton. And so that computer is the computer that got me through graduate school, and, you know, was everything. It was my, you know, my dialing computer. I remember going from, you know, 14.4 modem that it shipped with up to the 28.8 modem, and then from 28.8 to 35, and then from 35 to 56, you know, the small steps up the modem hierarchy. I remember, you know, getting a new monitor eventually that was a little bit better than, you know, my original one was like 640 by 480 straight VGA. I remember adding zip drives to it. I remember adding, you know, just all these other little add-ons that you had back then for that computer. Something wants to tell me that the computer itself was a couple thousand dollars. I mean, it was probably student loan money that bought the computer because I was in grad school. I remember waiting in line at the store for Windows 95 to come out. Like the commercials had been airing and Windows 95 is coming in. I remember waiting, and like people do now for iPhones, waiting in line so I could go buy Windows 95 the day it come out, and then went home and installed that on this Gateway 2000.
That was a huge release. That was transformative for the PC industry.
What was it like? It was like 12 or 16 floppy disks. If you didn't have a CD.
Yeah, it was huge.
Well,
yeah,
Office was huge. Back then was like 35 floppies.
So, you know, that was huge. I mean, and Windows 95 was made for the internet, right? It already had, and all that meant is you didn't already have to install
the TCP IP stack.
Yeah. Trumpet windsock.
Yeah, that's all that really meant is the IP stack was already there. And so, you know, I remember supporting a lot of Win95 when I got that tech support job, you know. And so, you know, just gutting the whole network stack and then adding it back in was easier than trying to fix it in the first place. So, yeah, so that's kind of my first hardware that I had. That computer lasted probably till I got my first job in mid to late 97, 98. So then I had a computer at work. Eventually, I think I ended up getting a laptop from work, which was more like a big brick.
It is funny you mentioned Egghead because I had forgotten they even existed. And they were a software and hardware shop that you used to find those in malls. And it looks like, I was like, whatever happened to them? They got bought by Amazon. They had a credit card breach in December of 2000 that really hurt their brand. And they were going to be bought by Fry's, it looks like. That fell through. And Amazon scooped up the entire company for $6 million in 2001. So do you guys remember Babbage's and software, et cetera? It was another...
Yeah, those were in the mall too in Memphis. So Brad, you were talking about going to the Metro. The Egghead that I went to wasn't in the mall, but it was right outside of the Mall of Memphis, which now is a huge asphalt parking lot. Like that mall got so bad in Memphis that they actually tore the whole thing down because by the time I actually left Ole Miss, they had changed, like, colloquial, it was referred to as the murder mall.
Yes, it was the murder mall, yes.
Because it had gotten that bag. But that's where that Egghead was in a little strips kind of center right outside of the mall, there outside the Mall of Memphis. So...
In the Mall of Memphis, you could find Babbage's and software, et cetera, and those as well. When I was a kid, that was the mall. And I remember going in 1998, I went to see The Wedding Singer. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is not the place to be. And it's funny over the years seeing all of those malls in Memphis, like the Southland Mall. I don't know if you remember the Southland Mall in Memphis. That was the mall that no one is supposed to go to type of place. And, you know, nothing will ever happen to this mall like this. I thought, wow, this is great. Seeing it fall into such a scary state by 98, it was pretty bad. There's a website where you can go and you can find dead malls online.
I was just about to mention that. I love that site.
I love that site too. I spent, I actually looked up the Memphis one on there. That was pretty funny. Of course, you know, I haven't been in that area near that area since probably 10 years ago. And even then it was Wolf Chase Galleria or Hickory Ridge. I don't even know if Hickory Ridge is still around. Wolf Chase Galleria was the one that I ended up going to about a decade ago because it was, you know, the Mall of Memphis was no more. Even if it had been there, I wouldn't have gone. But having software, et cetera, and Babbage's, and that brings back memories because they don't really have software stores anymore since everything is digital. It went the way of CD stores long before CD stores went away, which is kind of funny to me. They all just sort of, they all just almost vanished. Now all you see are video game stores, and I have a feeling that places like GameStop have a pretty short lifespan left in them as well.
Yeah, I guess that is kind of similar to today where, you know, then we had the software stores where you'd go buy your game or Office or, you know, whatever you needed for your computer. And, you know, they also sold the hardware as well, similar to the GameStops of today. Yeah, it's crazy. The places, not only is this stuff so old, it's the places we shopped are, you know, they're not even there anymore. They're parking lots. So that's how long ago this was.
They've been paved over.
That's how old we are, gentlemen. So bringing it back, sort of wrapping it up, I'll ask of both of you. So, you know, we do an Apple-centric podcast every week for the last, you know, nearly half a year at this point. Brad, what was the thing that got you into using Apple's computing equipment?
I was working at a law firm, and I worked there as their head network guy for 7 or 8 years. And right after the fourth or fifth generation iPod came out, a couple of the named partners, and those would be the guys with their names on the doors, a couple of the named partners showed up with MacBooks, and they hand them to me and to another guy that worked in the help desk, and they said, we want everything that we use on this. And they pretty much bought it sight unseen. And they show up expecting all of their case management software and stuff to work on it. And, you know, mind you, these are like G5 laptops before there was any kind of compatibility layer for going from power chips over to the Intel chips, the circa Leopard or Snow Leopard generation of macOS. So I went to my boss, who was the IT director, and I said, look, this guy that I work with and myself, we both need Macs. So we both got a MacBook Power Mac or MacBook Pro or whatever that model was in that year. And I'm thinking that was probably 2006 or seven. It had to be 2006 because they were still selling the Power Macs then. We basically had to cobble together some extra stuff on terminal server and in the network just to make it to where these lawyers could keep using their MacBooks, because there was no VMware, there was no parallels to run to emulate Windows on a Mac, and there certainly wasn't Boot Camp like you have now. I don't even know anybody who even uses Boot Camp, but we basically had to ramp up the application side of our Windows 2000 network so that we could have so those two lawyers could use this. I mean, we spent thousands of dollars on this just for these two lawyers. And then once theirs took off, we had a few more come along and they would want one. And then the other ones, you had the lawyers that would say, I like my compact PC, blah, 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 whatever. You know, this little thing I have running Windows 98, or I'm sorry, Windows XP. And it's like when the iPhones came along, and this is jumping way forward, but when the iPhone started to support Exchange, that's the only reason we updated our Exchange from Exchange 2000 to Exchange 2007 or 2010, was solely because of ActiveSync, which made it to where you could get your Exchange email on your iPhone. So we spent another, you know, probably $30,000 on licensing just for Exchange, just for these two or three lawyers that had new iPhones. So that was really my first experience, you know. Actually, I mean, I remember having used Macs while at Mississippi State in high school and thinking, man, these are so different from Windows 3.1 and Windows 95. I would sit down and feel kind of lost. And then after you were on it for a little while, doing whatever you may have been doing, you know, writing a paper or something, I would kind of click in my head and say, oh, this is kind of a cool computer.
And real quick, what made you leave whatever phone you were using for the iPhone when you first made that transition?
We were this was again at that same law firm, and we were a big BlackBerry shop. I mean, we probably had 600 or 700 employees, and all the lawyers had a BlackBerry. All of the IT staff had a BlackBerry, and a lot of the staff, you know, the staff that would have this lawyer's ear or that lawyer's ear would have also a BlackBerry. So we had a few hundred BlackBerries. And mind you, those go way back to where it was pretty much just a text-based pager and not really a phone. So you were still carrying like a little Nokia candy bar phone and a BlackBerry. So anyway, I waited until iOS could copy and paste. And then I switched over from the BlackBerry Bold. That was the last BlackBerry I had. And the first BlackBerry Bold still had that little glowing ball in the middle of it, whereas the second generation Bold had a little touch screen, a little touch for your thumb. But I went from a BlackBerry Bold, and I had just met Jim whenever I had my BlackBerry Bold. And I think he had already gotten an iPhone, and I was like, man, check this out. And he's like, that's a really cool phone. And it made me feel good about it, because a lot of people I knew had already been getting iPhones, and I felt kind of behind the times. But at the same time, I thought, well, I can still copy and paste on my phone, and these small shortcomings that the iPhone wasn't doing yet. So I think my first iPhone was a 3GS, which was the third generation.
Jim, what about you? How did you get involved with Apple's computers? What was your first exposure?
My very first exposure, as brief as it was, the summer between my junior and senior year in high school, I actually went up to Ole Miss for a honors program thing for a month, took some classes. We had Macs in a writing lab at Ole Miss. So I remember using those just briefly then. Didn't think much of it. You know, I had experience with PC clones that friends' parents had owned, or Commodore 64 or MyTandy. So I didn't think much of that. Fast forward quite a few number of years. My sister was at Ole Miss in graphic design and got a Mac. Shout out to Tammy, because I remember harassing her because I was such a PC homer then. You know, I truly was. You know, like I said, I stood in line for Windows 95 and I was, you know, whatever the newest Windows operating system is, I was right there. And so she had gotten a Mac. It was the little 12-inch MacBook Pro is what she got for college.
They didn't have MacBook Pros in those days.
Or it's not Pro, 12-inch
MacBook. It was
MacBook.
A PowerBook was metal. In those days, I believe. Yeah. A titanium PowerBook. Yeah. I'm our historian. Sorry, go ahead.
It was a 12-inch metal Mac. I remember seeing it and thinking, damn, that looks cool. I mean, that was just such a sweet little laptop. But still, I...
Every laptop before that was black plastic or white plastic. You know, it wouldn't... You, once you went to aluminum,
aluminium,
you were just blown away.
Yeah, the aluminium in that laptop was just, I mean, it was just an amazing laptop. I'm not sure what year that was. My first Mac, I'm not sure how far past that, was a late 2006 MacBook Pro, which I still have somewhere over in a box here at the apartment. And I'll send you a link, Brian, to the Every Mac post on for that one. So that was my first Mac, was the 15-inch late 2006. And I haven't owned, I don't think I've owned a personal PC since then. I've used Macs ever since. From that one, I went on to probably a 2010 or 2011 MacBook Pro, and then recently had my 2014 MacBook Pro. And that was the first one that I'd went down to the 13-inch instead of the 15, because I had a work computer that I used primarily, so I bought the smaller one. And then now I'm back to wanting another 15 for myself. And once I switched, I mean, it's kind of just been a no-brainer since then to, you know, to continue with the MacBook Pros. And I have the 2006, and then my second one, I think it's in the same box. I was using it for a little server to do stuff with for a while, until the battery did that thing it does where it kind of blows up and
got swole.
Makes your trackpad stick to where your trackpad doesn't move. That's the first sign is, whoa, my trackpad won't crunch down. What's wrong? And then you take the back off the laptop and you realize your battery is about 3 times thicker than it's supposed to be. And you're lucky your apartment's not on fire. So now neither one of those will operate without being plugged in, but they both still function. The actual second one that I got, the coolest thing I remember about it is I actually took the internal CD drive out of it and I bought a drive caddy, and I had two 256 SSDs in that one laptop. So I had replaced the hard drive that was in it with a little SSD where the CD-ROM drive, DVD drive was. I had had a caddy in there with a second 256 gig SSD.
That was
in
the OWC drive doubler.
Exactly. The OWC drive caddy, whatever they called it. That was just, you know, that computer was, it was fast. I mean, it was fast for years, it seems like. You know, even people that I would talk to, you know, with PCs, and, you know, I had this Mac that was 3 years old. It still seemed faster than anything anybody was buying on the PC side.
Jim, I remember when you put that first SSD in that Mac and you came over to my house for some reason or another, and you were like, check out this. And I swear that Mac booted in what it seemed like 6 to 8 seconds, and I was just blown away, because everything I had dealt with before that had been mechanical spinny drives.
Yeah, it was like magic. I mean, the first time you see an SSD, it's like magic, and that's what that was.
So what about your last iPhone your last phone before the iPhone, and what made you switch?
I think my last iPhone before the iPhone was a...
Your last iPhone before the iPhone?
Yeah, my last phone before the iPhone, all phones are iPhones now, was a Windows Phone candy bar. Like, not Windows, I guess, whatever they called them before Windows Phone, the...
Microsoft, Windows Mobile, I believe it was.
Yeah, Windows Mobile candy bar, because I had had Blackberries up until that time, and this little candy bar Windows Phone with the slide out keyboard just seemed really cool. And I remember getting that, and much like Kickstarters that we talked about a couple episodes ago, it looked much cooler in the pictures and the documentation than it actually worked, because it was so quirky. It was just, you know, weird things about this phone that, yeah, I just didn't like it at all.
Man, Windows Mobile was such a fragmented piece of garbage. And, you know, it was sort of like Android is now. And I mean Android, the operating system, where Android does one thing on one piece of hardware and does a completely different thing on another piece of hardware.
And I had a bunch of phones before then. I mean, I remember using the Palm Trios. Those were cool. I had Blackberries. Those, you know, were awesome for the day. And
so what made you switch?
A friend of mine in Jackson, Greg, had gotten the first iPhone, the metal-bodied one. And I remember just thinking, this is so cool. But at that point, they were $600. There was no subsidies. It was AT&T only, and it was $600, which a couple months later, they actually gave $200 back to anybody who bought it, which was just crazy because they had dropped the prices. And so I really, really wanted one. And by that point, I had moved to Texas. And I remember going to the mall and standing in line at the Apple store for the 3G. It was, okay, they're switching, they're going to 3G. We're actually going to be able to do the faster speeds. And that was my first iPhone was, you know, I'd seen Greg's original iPhone and was like, yeah, this is really sweet. You know, I can use it with my Mac. It integrates with iTunes. It's got all this stuff. And so my first iPhone was the 3G. And I switched to AT&T at that time. I forget what I was on before that. It might have been like...
That was back before the App Store. So, I mean, your phone was essentially a phone and MP3 player.
An iPod. It was an iPod with a phone.
By the time the 3G came out, I think the App Store was either imminent or it wasn't long after. The people that had the very first iPhone, that is absolutely a true statement. By the time the 3G came along, though, I think the App Store came out in 2008, and that's when the 3G came out at some point in that year. So it wasn't long.
Yeah, it was right around then. And, you know, the first apps, you know, I remember, you know, the first apps that I could still look back at my purchase history and see, maybe we should do an episode about that. Look way back in our iTunes purchase history and see what some of the first apps.
It was a flashlight app that turned your screen white.
So anyway, yeah, so that's how I ended up with the 3G. And I've had most iPhones since. Every now and then I've skipped one. But yeah, the 3G and that 2006 MacBook Pro changed my life, sort of.
So for me, plot twist, secret history that gets inserted into my previous story. I mentioned my previous computers, but I left out the computers that I used all through elementary school, which were Apple II and Apple IIe computers. So technically speaking, my first computers that were Apple were the Apple II computers that I used at school. And for a while there, at the same time that I was using the Amiga at home, when I would have a study hall or a free moment, I was trying to write things, and I would Nibble Magazine, Nibble, was an Apple II-based magazine that I used to read, and I would get code and little snippets out of there. So I used those for a long time. I remember maybe by around the time I was a senior in high school or in college, some of the cool folks that were doing graphics at the Apple II GS. I remember seeing a lot of those in use, particularly for those that were doing publishing, desktop publishing types of work. And just like Jim, I would go to Ware Hall and many of the computers in that lab. So if you left the part that had the VT100 WISE terminals that we talked about in the last episode, on the other side of the lab, they had nothing but Macs. And I was never particularly impressed because they had no multitasking. They were single threaded. You couldn't really do more than one thing at a time. Very primitive to use. I pretty much didn't even touch a Mac until 2009. And on a lark, I bought a cheap netbook. Remember when netbooks were still a thing? And it was one of the Dell netbooks that you could turn into a very cheap $200 Hackintosh. And that was my first foray into using a Mac of sorts. And it ran Snow Leopard. It was great. And I enjoyed that so much that same year I went and got an iMac. Now, of course, that was, I guess, what, 7 years ago at this point. So haven't been using it nearly as long as you guys. For the iPhone, my story is almost identical to Brad's. I had a BlackBerry Bold. And when the first iPhone came out, got a lot of press, got a lot of attention, got a lot of excitement. I remember going to a conference in California where they were giving them away as prizes. And I thought, yeah, that's great. I'm not going to do this until it does 3G. So once the 3G came out, I think early 2009, again, apparently that was my year of Apple, I bought a 3G in March or April of 2009. And this is back when the phones used to come out during WWDC, and I didn't know that. So I had had my 3G for maybe 2 or 3 months when the 3GS was announced, and I promptly sold it on eBay and had 3GS on launch day, and I've had every iPhone on launch day since then. But I kept the BlackBerry Bold because it was a work phone. So for many years, I kept a BlackBerry long after that. So it wasn't until 2014, the very beginning of 2014, that's when I knew the iPhone had reached its critical mass, when my employer finally allowed us to ditch those. So for about 9 months in 2014, I carried two iPhones, which was weird but kind of nice. I was able to finally ditch that BlackBerry once and for all. But yeah, that was my story of that. So just having a computer where I didn't know the OS backwards and forwards was kind of nice. Being a Unix guy for so long and having an OS that was built on top of Unix that, you know, you could drop to a command line and still have a lot of the same things that you had before. I had played with Darwin, the BSD variant that OS X was built on, many years prior, but never really had a Mac to run it on. So it was kind of nice to actually make that switch. But I never, unlike you guys, I never abandoned the PC. I've always had a PC still, mostly for game playing and that type of thing, but or Blu-ray ripping or what have you. So still fun though. Well, that's our show for this week. That's our little trip down memory lane. Only the most hardcore, dedicated people will have probably been able to make it through this and even know what we were talking about, or you'd have to be of a certain age. But it's been fun. So until next time, have a good week. Say goodbye, fellas.
Goodbye, fellas.
Fellas.
please visit infiniteloopback.com for show notes and previous episodes. We can be found on Twitter. I'm at Brian B. That's B-R-I-A-N-B. Jim is at Big Jim. That's B-I-G-J-I-M. And Brad is at Meester Idle. That's M-E-E-S-T-E-R-I-D-L-E. Thanks for listening, and we hope to talk to you next time.